I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times.
Mr. Dynamite, the amazing Mr. Please Please himself, the star of the show, James Brown and the Famous Flame.
That's Fats Gonder introducing James Brown to the stage at the Apollo Theater in 1963 from the album Live at the Apollo. Much has been written about Brown's life on and off the stage and his influence on the culture. But there's always been something elusive and unknowable about the Godfather of Soul. Our guest James McBride wanted to find out about the real James Brown and went to South Carolina and Georgia to talk with Brown's family and the people who knew him and worked with him. His book, Kill 'Em and Leave, is about how the South influenced Brown as a man and a musician. It's also about the pitched battle over Brown's $100 million estate that he had left to help poor kids, none of whom have received a penny. James McBride is a writer and a musician. He's the author of several books, including most recently, The Good Lord Bird, about John Brown, which won the National Book Award. And James McBride, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back. Thank you.
You're very welcome. You admit in this book pretty early on that one of the reasons you wrote it was you needed the dough. You needed the cash.
The moolah, yes.
The moolah.
Yes. Yes.
People don't often say that.
I needed the moolah. Yeah, that's true. I was going through a very difficult emotionally and financially draining divorce, and The Good Lord Bird had not yet been published. I hadn't even finished it, actually.
Wow.
So this book fell in my lap. It wasn't something that I sought. You know, I was approached by, you know, a guy who knew a guy, an agent who knew an agent, one of those deals. And I followed it up and initially decided not to do it. It seemed like it was just too fraught with difficulty. But then, you know, my agent sold the idea, and I needed the money, so I took it. And, you know, I love James Brown as well, so.
Well, in fact, you grew up was it the Bronx, I guess?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn and later Queens. And Queens, in my old neighborhood, James Brown's house was not far from my house. So I used to go there when I was a kid. Oh, a lot of us did.
And stare at it, right?
Just yeah, we used to hear a rumor that if he came out, he'd give you $50 if you promised you'd stay in school.
Well, so, your sister actually went and had the temerity to knock on the front door.
My sister Dottie went and actually did something no kid in my neighborhood ever thought to do. She just knocked on the door. And a servant of some type came to the door and said, "What do you want?" She said, "I want to talk to James Brown." And he came to the door.
And what did he say?
He said, "Stay in school, Dottie. Don't be no fool."
Did he give her $50?
No, he didn't give her. He didn't give her a penny. But he, but he did inspire her to come home and share that story with every. I mean, she became a made member of the mob after that. I mean, she was a big deal. You know, she had actually talked to the Godfather of Soul.
You have worked as a journalist. Did you feel like you had to kind of put on your journalist hat or use your journalist chops to write this book in a way? You went south to kind of find some answers to some questions about James Brown.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if I hadn't had a reporter's background, I would have never been able to do this book. Because first of all, a lot of books have been done. And secondly, there are a lot of these linear books that he recorded this, and then he traveled here, and then he got married. And I didn't want to write that kind of, those kinds of books. I usually just flip to the end to see how the guy dies, you know. So I didn't want to write that kind of book. I wanted to write what really happened. What was, you know, what was the guy really like? And what was his community like? And what did he really want? And so I had to basically ferret out and write two books, really. The first book is not a book that's not published. It's the first book was he did this, he did that, he did this. And then the second book is this book, which is like this is the analysis of what he meant, not only to what he meant to us and why his life is a metaphor for American life, really.
But he makes clear, and the people that knew him made clear, was that he did not want to be known. In fact, you quote, I think it's his manager, who says, James Brown, he did not want to be known.
Well, no, he didn't. He didn't. He hid, you know, he hid the better parts from himself, from the world, in part because part of that had to do with his background, because he grew up very poor. Part of that had to do with the fact that he lived in the South most of his life, even as an old man. And he was always afraid that the evil of the white man would fall on him like raindrops at some point. He was always nervous about his money. He'd been clean to the IRS, clean to the walls by the IRS twice. And he just he was in a world where being weak was a problem. Hmm. He had to run this business. He had all these band members, and later in life, you know, and later in history, they would complain about how they were treated and they never were paid well. And James Brown never had any say in any of that. In fact, you know, he the question you have to ask is if they were that great and he was that bad, why haven't we heard of them, you know, later? The fact is, but there's another side to that as well. I mean, most of his great songs were co-written by Pee Wee Ellis, the saxophonist, and Fred Wesley, the trombonist. And their memories of James Brown are very different than what you read, what the biographers talk about, because they both loved him and hated him. They understood him. They understood he was a very complicated guy, and he didn't want people to know him. He didn't want people to know him that he was weak. But he was at bottom was a very kind and sensitive person, and had a big heart for people who were poor, and had really no respect for people who didn't work.
Well, I would actually love to have you read a section. You did go south, I guess we can say that here in the north. You went south. And spent a fair amount of time at a restaurant,
there's a restaurant in Barnwell, South Carolina, where James Brown was born and where he lived and where he died. And when I went down there to check into his life, I ended up spending a lot of time in this restaurant because some of these people knew him, some of his relatives. So the whole thing kind of hit me one afternoon when I was sitting there and this guy wandered in, and I'll just read about it.
Sure.
The whole thing came crashing down on me one afternoon when a fellow named Joe Louis Thomas wandered in. Joe was a well-built, handsome, brown-skinned man who worked in New York as a professional wrestler. Tired of being told to throw matches intentionally for a few dollars, he returned home to South Carolina, got married, sent two of his three kids to college, one of whom, Joe Thomas Jr., joined the Green Bay Packers in 2014. Then Joe went back to college himself at South Carolina State University and joined the track and football team at age 51. He'd grown up hauling cotton off a white man's field in Blackfield, South Carolina, with all 11 of his siblings. For most of his life, Joe was considered deaf. Only his outstanding skill as a football player, he ran a 40-yard dash in 4.35 seconds in high school, kept him in school. One day, when he was 17, a doctor stuck a probe in Joe's ear. The doc pulled out 17 years' worth of trash, cotton, junk, dirt. Now that Joe Thomas could hear again, he'd heard things he'd never heard before. He saw things he'd never seen before. Joe came into the restaurant and sat down across from me, and the lady who owned it, Miss Perry Lee, said, "Hey, Joe, your buddy from New York is back." Joe looked at me. "You still working on that book?" he asked. I said I was. I gave him the whole deal, having a hard time telling the real story. Terrible court case about Mr. Brown's will, a lot of fighting, got a bunch of questions with no answers, trying to get to the bottom of things, blah, blah, blah. Joe listened silently, holding his fork loosely. It hung in the air as I spoke. When I was done, he still held his fork over his plate of liver and collard greens. "You watch yourself out here," he said softly. "I haven't done anything wrong," I said. "It's just a book." Joe looked at me steady, silent. He pointed his fork at me and said, "You watch yourself out here, young man."
That's James McBride reading from his new book about James Brown. So what was he warning you about?
Well, about the evils of folks who want all James Brown's money, who are running around South Carolina and Georgia doing terrible things to one another. And that's true. The man who went to jail for allegedly stealing James Brown's money was James Brown's accountant, a 68-year-old white man, Republican, good old boy, who did everything James Brown asked him to do. And he was never deposed. He went to jail. Just before he went to jail, his son was murdered by two black kids who broke into the house, and then his ex-wife died driving to the hospital to see her son. And as far as I'm concerned, this guy is innocent. But he was the perfect villain, you know. Old white man, good old boy, Southerner, talk like a Southerner, look like a Southerner. I think James Brown would be very upset to see what happened to this fellow, because James Brown trusted this man with his money.
And he didn't trust a lot of people, it seems.
He trusted no one with his money. James Brown was very, very tight with his money. He trusted no one. He buried his money at all different kinds of places. He buried it, you know, I'm sure this James Brown's money's buried somewhere, because he didn't believe in banks.
In the ground, you think? Or
well, you know, he told his manager and his accountant, and they said to him one day, Mr. Brown, what are you going to do, you know, when you die? If something happens to you, what about your money? You know, he wrote one word on a piece of yellow legal pad. He just wrote, dig.
The enigmatic James Brown. You say some interesting things about the South. One is that it's a land of masks.
I don't think you can understand James Brown without understanding the South, really. There's a familiarity, first of all, between whites and blacks in the South that those of us in the North really don't understand. They have a kind of everyone's in their place, everyone knows their place kind of society. And if you step out of that, you know, you're breaking all kinds of rules, unspoken rules. You know, the fact is James Brown was more of a Southerner than he was a black man, really. Huh. And at the end of his life, the people who ran his business with him were three Southerners, two of them white and one of them black. And they eventually became the trustees of his estate. And they were eventually moved out after he died. But he really felt that the dynamics of race in the South were much more open and thus easier to negotiate than the dynamics mm-hmm. of race in the North. He felt like in the North, they like you, they say they want you, but then they when you leave the room, they say goodbye and don't come back. Whereas in the South, they're very open about the racism and so forth. I don't know if it's...
You think that's true? Or true
it's not
today?
As true. Well, it's not as true today as it was, 30 years ago. But no, I think it's still pretty true. I mean, you know, let's face it. You know, this Donald Trump campaign is all about, 80% of it's about race. Black people are certainly not surprised that these people are coming out the woodwork saying, you know, we want America back, give us our country back, you know. I mean, changing times.
Code words, you think?
Oh, please. I mean, a 15-year-old could figure that out. I mean, the real question you have to ask yourself, and which is asked in this book to some degree, is how can we learn to talk to each other about things that are not comfortable? Because personally, I'm tired of talking about race. I just want to talk about solutions. I'm not interested in problems. James Brown, at the end of his life, was interested only in solutions. He left $100 million... his entire estate, his likeness, his music, everything, to educate poor children in South Carolina and Georgia. And he was specific, poor white and black children. He says, enough of the race thing. 10 years later, not a single kid has received a dime of that money. The money's tied up in courts. You got 90 lawyers, 48 lawsuits, 4,000 pages of testimony. I'm interested in what Mr. Brown was interested in. By the way, you had to call him Mr. Brown. You didn't call him James.
That's
ever.
True. That's true. Mr. Brown.
Yeah. But Mr. Brown was interested in solutions. And that's in part what this book is about.
That's James McBride, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's been a guest on the show a number of times talking about previous books, The Color of Water, his memoir, a novel called Miracle at St. Anna, and also more recently, The Good Lord Bird about John Brown, his book that won the National Book Award. And we're talking about his new book about James Brown, Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Please, 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 please. So, please, please.
Brown's first hit, Please, 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 from 1956, co-written with Johnny Terry and performed by Brown and his band, The Famous Flames. Talking with James McBride about James Brown. He's got a new book called Kill Him and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. He had a really interesting long-term relationship with a guy named Leon Austin, and it didn't seem like James Brown had long-time friends besides this guy. What was the nature of their relationship?
He met Leon Austin when he moved from Barnwell County to Augusta, Georgia, when he was 7, 8, or 9. There's some differences of opinion about James Brown's true age.
Right.
But they were in class together, and James Brown lived on the other side of town. And Leon Austin lived right down the street from United House of Prayer, which was a big church. And Leon Austin befriended James Brown, who at the time was this little snotty-headed kid, you know, snotty kid with, you know, nappy hair and never clean and so forth. And they became friends for life. And Leon Austin gave James Brown his first piano lessons. And Leon Austin was a very good pianist. He was actually recorded some records, and he was a very good singer as well. So he took James Brown to the United House of Prayer. And that's where James Brown first saw the I think they call themselves the Thunder. It's a shout band where they play a type of music that I've never heard before. They play continuously. Lots of horns. Like when I was there, it must have been like 20 horns.
Wow.
Trombones playing high C's. And they play a blend of New Orleans style and gospel that is unlike anything you've ever heard. And James Brown heard that when he was a boy, and he was very attracted to that. And then Leon Austin taught him how to play piano. He got his first piano lessons from Leon Austin, and they became friends for life.
Yeah.
They traveled together. He trusted Leon. He trusted Leon and Leon's wife, Emma. And they were close friends until Leon's death, and then Miss Emma was close friends with Mr. Brown until he died. That was one person he did trust. In part, I think, because Leon was very kind-hearted. And also, he was a little bit of an outsider in his own family as well.
Yeah. Interesting. Charles Bobbitt, who was, his manager?
Charles Bobbitt was his manager for 41 years, and I spent quite a bit of time with him.
You asked him what was the deepest feeling about the white man. I mean, what was James Brown's deepest feeling about the white man? And Charles Bobbitt says, fear.
Yeah, well, you know.
What do you mean?
I think it was that old Southern thing where you never really knew where the evil was coming from or when it might arrive. You have to remember James Brown went to jail when he was 16 for like stealing car parts or something like that. He'd witnessed a lot of brutal racist behavior. His great 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 grandfather was actually from Georgia and escaped to South Carolina by swimming across the Savannah River. And that's really where James Brown's family started. His family actually started in a place called Ellington, South Carolina.
Wow.
And that's never really been discovered or written about before. So he was very clear about, he was very, as most Southern blacks of that time were, very knowledgeable that, you know, one wrong step, you don't tip your hat this way and so forth, something bad could happen to you. So he was always nervous and afraid of the white man's evil, if you will. Now, later on in life, you know, that flipped itself around so many different ways because he became a star and then became an entertainment star. I mean, that became a kind of, you know, a monster almost, only because he just had such weird feelings about racism and white people and working, and he was a conservative guy, you know. It was just bizarre.
And also part of civil rights. I mean,
it's part of civil rights. I mean, you know, he was called upon on two occasions to quell riots after Martin Luther King died in Boston and Washington, D.C. But again, you know, it's not a clean story. It's not a clean story. It's not like he walked in like Malcolm X, who, you know, didn't cheat on his wife. Well, now, you know, someone says he did. But, you know, it was not a clean story. He did these things, and he did them well, and he understood people respected him. But his own life was a tumultuous mixture of good, bad, evil, and ugly.
Anything that you learned about his childhood? I mean, he had a memoir, an autobiography, others have written. Anything that helped you understand James Brown?
I'm sure that a lot of – look, James Brown in his autobiography described himself as like being part Asian Afro, and then he was related to Geronimo. I mean, come on. But I think part of that was a tax dodge because he felt like if he was Indian – he even said it. If he was Indian, he wouldn't have to pay taxes.
Makes you wonder about memoirs, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to go rewrite mine now.
Yeah, exactly.
Find out my mother was a Nigerian from, like, you know, right. Lagos.
Right, instead of the Jewish lady that raised you, right?
I found out a lot. I mean, well, first of all, I found out that James Brown really is a child of the nuclear age. His family began in Ellenton, South Carolina. And this is a region in South Carolina. It's near the Savannah River. And now that reached, in 1951, General Electric and the American government and DuPont Company basically took 361 square miles of land, cleared six towns in all, several, I think it was 8,000 or 9,000 people, more than that, 8,000 sharecroppers and 2,000 or 3,000. I'm not sure the numbers, but it was a lot of sharecroppers, mostly black people. They cleared them out and they built a nuclear bomb-making facility. This was in 1951. It was the Cold War. So all these people, white and black, had to move. It's on churches, homes, graveyards. Everything was moved.
And people were on their own, sort of go find a place to live?
If you owned a house, they would give you the price of the house. If you wanted to take the house with you, they would pick the house up and move it for you within reason. But the black sharecroppers, including James Brown's family, who owned nothing, who just picked the white man's cotton, they were just dispersed. They were pitiful. I mean, they had nowhere to go, so they just went where they could. And so James Brown's family was part of that. They were dispersed, six towns in all. Everything that was there is gone, and the only thing that's left are the driveways and the signs. And he never forgot that. He never forgot that. Even when he died, his house was within sight of the very land where his family lived. And he would go out on his porch, and he would tell Charles Bobbitt, he said, you know, they had these big radio towers at the Savannah River nuclear site, and he'd say, Mr. Bobby, you see those towers? That's the government. They can listen. They're listening to me through my teeth. You know, he was so paranoid about, but he didn't want to leave the land that he came from. And all of those people, white and black, were displaced. And there was no protest. I mean, what happened was some trucks showed up one day. It was a big announcement. You got to go because America needs to be safe.
Right. This is 51, as you
1951.
Say.
And there was a big meeting in town. And all the merchants, everyone had to move. And that's how it is today.
Is the nuclear? I mean,
the nuclear bomb making facility is still there. The Savannah River site is still there,
and there's still vines growing all over it. Or
no, the Savannah River nuclear site still makes nuclear bombs. You know, as far as I can tell,
wow.
I mean, I don't know what they're doing with the nuclear waste. I think there's some question about some of these cement bunkers they built to bury some of the nuclear. I think that has sort of emerged. But look, South Carolina is like a different world. It's like 50 years behind. I mean, it feels like it's 50 years behind the rest of America.
Mm.
And some of those involved with James Brown's will and estate are the same people that, for example, you know, when Obama gave his address and the guy said, you lie?
Yes.
Well, his son is the Attorney General of South Carolina, who just got into some trouble, And he was one of the ones who was involved in rewriting James Brown's will. They do whatever they want down there. What they really need is some kind of federal oversight so they can, like, make, because they have their own set of laws down there. I mean, I've never seen anything like it.
Was that the thing in a way, not that you stumbled upon as you were writing this, but sort of you ran headlong into the fact that he had an estate of $100 million, maybe even more, when he died, with the idea that this was going to go to poor kids in South Carolina and Georgia to help them with their education, their lives. And lo and behold, it becomes the object or the subject of one lawsuit after another, teams of lawyers, and nothing ever spent.
Well, first of all, I didn't even want to write about it. And I don't write about it in the book that much because that stuff is boring and people don't want to read it. I don't even want to read it. I had to go through it to figure it out. I had to figure out a way to say it.
If it tells you something, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's how lawyers work. You know, they bore you to tears with it and then they just collect money and this is how they do it. Look, in the old days, 30 years ago, a story that smelled this bad would have wafted right up here to Philadelphia. And the Inquirer, the old Inquirer, was run by Gene Roberts and Jim Norton.
You used to work for the old Inquirer.
I was a freelancer there for a long time. And I could tell you could throw a rock across that newsroom and you could hit one of anybody sitting around there would go down to South Carolina and they would open this thing up. They would kick the walls and then the networks would come in and finish the job and that would be it. But American newspapers are not what they were. Hmm. And so you don't have oversight for these kinds of state problems that are, you know, because reporters, the newspapers, only now are the internet sites starting to muscle up a little bit. But this shouldn't have gone on this long. But, you know, there's no oversight.
But is this, I mean, is part of your book, your job as a writer to expose this?
My job is to just say whatever it is. I mean, that's the last thing in the world I want to do is be Woodward and Bernstein and say, sir, you know,
well,
I want to talk to you.
You did write about it, though.
Well, yeah, I mean, because that's the truth. You just have to say what's there. I didn't want to do it because I don't like that kind of work. But I took the job, you know. Yeah. And they don't pay you the big bucks to go down there and say, you know, fluff. I mean, most of the books about James Brown, even the most current ones, they don't talk anything about this lawsuit because the writers just didn't bother to, you know, try to figure it out. But I figured it out. I think Mr. Brown would have liked me to figure it out. I think that's why I was called to do it. You know, maybe it was God's work. Who knows?
Mm. And he was Mr. Brown. I mean, there were certain things that he did that were sort of uniquely the way he wanted to be treated.
I never
Mr.
heard
Mr. Brown to everybody, right?
Yeah, he called everyone else by their surnames as well. I think it harked back to his childhood when he was just a nobody, you know. But he called, you know, Miss Emma, you know.
You interviewed his first wife, Velma.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it seemed like even though the marriage didn't last, the relationship did. I mean, it seems like they had a real fondness for each other.
Yeah, he called her from the hospital as he was dying. He didn't even tell her he was in the hospital dying. That hurt her, too.
Yeah.
That he wouldn't tell her that, that he didn't tell her that. But they were good friends. Because, see, Miss Velma, she could have at any point, you know, and she had lawyers who showed up at her door and said, I can get you lots of money. But what she asked for him when he left, because she knew Toccoa, Georgia was not the place for him, and she let him go, you know. It wasn't about him living in Bobby Bird's basement and trying to make, I mean, that's record company stuff. She saw that there was no future for him there. And she saw that he was seeing a bigger world. And she said to him, you know, if you're going to go, go. But we have these two boys, and I need a place for them to live. So James Brown bought a piece of property, built a house there, and he handed the deed to the house. And she never asked him for another dime. She worked in a factory for 30 years. Never asked him for a dime. And he would always go back to Toccoa, Georgia, to see her. When her relatives died, her family died, he always showed up. No matter where he was, he would come back.
Their son, Teddy, was what? It was a car crash, right?
Their son Teddy, their oldest son, died when he was 19. He was in a car crash driving to Canada with two other people, and they just ran into a bridge abutment, and they died. Mm-hmm. And Teddy died, and it really broke both of their hearts. And Teddy apparently was deeply talented, much admired and loved in his community, and that really destroyed a lot of James Brown's life, I think.
In what way? I mean,
because
he
had great expectations for his two oldest boys. You know, he wanted them to do things that he did not do. His second son, Terry, was accepted into Morehouse, and he was a very good basketball player, academic star. But when Teddy died, when the oldest one died, the whole thing fell apart. Terry never went to Morehouse. He went to a different school. He didn't finish. He had problems, and him and his father fought for years after that. Teddy was the kind of the glue that kept the thing together.
And then once he died,
that whatever existed of that fractured family kind of fell apart. Mm. I mean, Mr. Brown and Miss Velma they stayed friends for life. And he has a grandson from that side of the family that he was close to. But basically, when Teddy died, there was a part of James Brown that never returned.
Mm. Your book is titled Kill Him and Leave, and that's something that James Brown would say. I mean, about how he would perform, which is put it all on the stage.
Well, something he used to tell Al Sharpton. You know, people don't know that Al Sharpton was at James Brown's feet for 15 years. And he would tell Al Sharpton, you know, kill him and leave, Rev. In other words, he would let the band warm up and get the audience loose. People start screaming. Mm-hmm. He knew exactly when to walk out on stage and just burn the house down. And then he'd come out, and then he'd get his hair done.
For a couple hours,
Couple hours under the dryer. Talk to Al Sharpton. And Al Sharpton would say, I didn't talk. Mr. Brown would talk. Because he couldn't hear what you said anyway. And he would just yak, 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 yak. And then when he got his hair done, he would just leave. He wouldn't stay around and talk to stars. And he felt very competitive with with, you know, Motown and the uh-huh. other black stars and with the white stars. He was very competitive. Yeah.
And was this part of his I don't want to be known? I mean, I'm a performer, but I don't want you close to who I actually am.
Well, yeah, yes, but he also just wanted to be the best. You know, he wanted to be last. I mean, there's a very, very good telling video online, the Tammy Show in 1964, where he
Tammy,
you know,
Terrell?
No, it's the Tammy Show.
Oh, the Tammy Show.
It was in 1964. You can see it on the internet, where he was told that the Rolling Stones, which is the new band of the moment, would be closing the show and that he couldn't close the show. Now, they portrayed that in that movie, which had a lot of inaccuracies in it. But according to Charles Bobbitt, they didn't even give James Brown a dressing room. He had to do his dance moves and rehearse in the auditorium on the slope stage floor. So when it was his time to perform and they wouldn't let him close the show, he just basically turned it all the way out. I mean, James Brown, there are some people, Frank Sinatra, James Brown, you just better not follow them, you know. So he just turned it out, and then the Rolling Stones had to follow. And if you see the Rolling Stones performance, I mean, if you're a Rolling Stones fan, that's probably not the performance you want to take a look at.
And he didn't much care for that. Was it because of how he was treated, or
he didn't think they were anything special, you know? I mean, I'm told that when the Red Hot Chili Peppers came down to see James Brown in Augusta, something like that, he just refused to see him. He didn't want to see him. Huh. And when he was at the Zaire, the big fight in Zaire, where he performed with George Foreman and Muhammad Ali fought. The President Mobutu made it clear that he had certain gifts for the performers if they wanted to come and visit his, you know, castle, whatever he was. James Brown left the venue and went to the airport and sat for 4 hours. He didn't want to see nobody's Mobutu.
James McBride, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about James Brown, the subject of his new book called Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. We had a bunch of music queued up, and I won't do justice to all of them, but we're going to take a very short break, play a little bit of music and another reading as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I feel good. I knew that I would not. So good, so good. I got a year. Oh, I feel nice. A sugar and spice. I feel nice. A sugar and spice.
Brown's 1966 single hit, I Got You, I Feel Good, on James McBride and I rocking back and forth here. But I do remember something that you wrote in The Color of Water, your memoir, that you were one of the worst dancers that God has ever put on this earth.
That would be true.
Is that
yes,
still
indeed.
True?
I'd dance like a white guy with one finger in the air.
I know what that looks like.
Yeah, well, with two beers, I can dance like, you know, two white guys with two fingers in the air.
Well, I'd actually love to have you read another section from the book. And this is really, I mean, you are a jazz musician, I should say, to our listeners. So I was very interested in this section, looking, sort of comparing jazz and funk.
All right. Well, this is describing the differences between the two for players, people who play the music. Let me take a moment to mention groove here and funk. When I was coming up, a lot of serious jazz players couldn't stand funk. Their reasoning, it was technically simple. Unlike jazz, there was no harmonic or technical challenge, no furious chord changes that required mathematical efficiency in your head to figure out where the thing was going and how to make your knowledge of theory and harmony fit. Jazz requires a blend of split-second timing, skill, and training. It's like playing basketball. You need a lot of skills to play basketball: running, jumping, shooting, defense, conditioning. On the pro level, you have to put all these things to use and shoot the ball with a guy your size or bigger sticking a finger in your eye with one hand, pulling your shorts down with the other, and calling your mother names. Jazz soloing is akin to that. Funk soloing, on the other hand, is more akin to playing baseball. Baseball requires athletic talent, but specific learned skills that have to be exercised flawlessly. Hitting a curveball can only be learned through years of practice. No matter how gifted you are athletically, you cannot step up to home plate and hit an 80-mile-per-hour major league curve or splitter without learning how to do it. And you cannot swing at every pitch. You only get 3 strikes. So you have to recognize the pitch in a split second, decide where it's going to break, adjust to it, and know when to swing. And you must do this flawlessly, enough to stay on the team anyway. That's why funk is as challenging as jazz. You must know when to enter the groove and what to play. Funk, or any good music, requires space. Knowledge of when to throw in your small contributions and when to lay out. Musical silence is one reason trumpeter Miles Davis was such an extraordinary musician. He epitomized the use of space. There were gorgeous silences in Miles' music. Many jazz players, especially horn players, can't adapt to the demands of space that funk requires. They find funk frustrating and blow right past it. That's why Brown's longtime saxophone soloist Maceo Parker is so revered. There are dozens of horn players more skilled than Maceo. They have more chops. They play better, faster, more. But Maceo, like Miles Davis, knew when to play and when not to play. He knew how to groove. He played with simplicity, which is difficult. He played so rhythmically that he basically played the drums on saxophone.
I love that section. I just thought, I mean, I felt like I understood something, or now I understand something about jazz and funk and also music, and also about those spaces, which is obviously so important to music.
Well, I mean, you know, I have a friend who was going to Berkeley, and he said he was taking a counterpoint, and he was having trouble learning counterpoint. So he called a buddy, and he said, I'm having trouble learning counterpoint. And his buddy said to him, what are you talking about? Just put on some James Brown. Because James Brown's music is full of counterpoint, particularly the guitar work and the horns, how they knock up against each other, and each has its own little space. Now, that's not James Brown's genius. That was the genius of Jimmy Nolan, his great guitar player, Pee Wee Ellis and Fred Wesley, who were his arrangers, Clyde Stubblefield and Jabba Starks, who was drummers, and Bernard Odom, who was his longtime bassist. These men knew how to work with the little limited space they could to make the music go. It's sort of like if you listen to Bach and you pull out the third violin string part to a piece of a Bach concerto, it makes perfect sense. If you pull out the guitar part to a James Brown song, it doesn't make quite the same musical sense that violin part makes, but it still has its own musical sensibility. Huh. And, you know, the entire music industry, these computers and these samplers, and a lot of them are based on the things that James Brown and his band, particularly his band, did.
Huh. We have an email from Alexis that said, did being a musician yourself help in writing the James Brown book?
Yeah, because, I mean, I think if I wasn't a musician, I wouldn't have taken on the matter. I mean, because I loved his music. And as a kid, I was one of the few jazz players I knew who liked James Brown. When I was a kid, a lot of jazz guys didn't like James Brown.
Why not?
Because they just, you know, they were into jazz, and jazz was cool, and, you know, he was funk, and, you know, funk was easy. You know, I remember meeting one of the guys from the Art Ensemble of Chicago. I think his name was Lester Bowie, and he was saying what a great musician James Brown was. And I mean, I always liked his music, and I always liked certain funk players, you know. And I think a musician who really understands the evolution of African-American music cannot help but to admire what James Brown, and most importantly, what his musicians did. Because his musicians never got really a lot of credit for what they did.
We always have to reconcile famous people's public and private lives, and certainly that's true with James Brown and his treatment of women, his wives, girlfriends, children. Do you wrestle with that at all?
I didn't go into that too much. You know, he had a good marriage to his first wife. He was married to his second wife for a long time. His third wife was a drug addict and kind of pulled him into drugs or vice versa. And his fourth wife was a background singer in his band who he married. I'm hoping to get a job as a background singer in somebody else's band so they could marry me and then I could not have to work.
You're
so
eligible?
Hard. Yes. I'm going to get a back. I'm just going to sing background with Adele. How's that?
Not bad. But you do write here, as I say, as gently as I can, that it doesn't change the facts. The man had four wives. He reportedly slept with some of his female singers, had all kinds of fights with women. I'm told his treatment of Motown singer Tammy Terrell was terrible. He was charged with rape. He had at least four outside children besides the six he claimed. I've heard there's as many as 13. This kind of bad news ain't the same as stealing your best friend's lunch money.
No, it's not, and I'm very clear about that. But on the other hand, I'm just not the type of journalist that goes around writing that kind of stuff. It's just not my style. I mean, the book isn't really about his relationship with his wives and his 13 or so children. I'm just not one of those types of people. I mean, I covered Michael Jackson during the 1984 Victory Tour. I was one of the few journalists, like real journalists, who covered it. And I covered it from the rehearsals to the end. And there was just a lot of stuff that I just never wrote about, never will write about. I mean, some people deserve, you know, some semblance of privacy. In this internet age, you know, you can say anything, and you don't have to sign your name, and you can write a review, and you can be sitting in Idaho somewhere and just ruin someone's life. You know, step up to it. So I wasn't that interested in that stuff because it's been written about already, for one thing. And the other thing is, what's the purpose of writing that? If we know that already. So why are we writing it again? I mean, what's the purpose of saying it? Somebody's already said it. Right. If you can't say something different, you probably shouldn't say it. You shouldn't write the book.
So how should we think differently about then James Brown?
Well, I think the way to think about him is how to think differently is that his life and the way his life was conducted is a metaphor for how we deal with each other. Because we always saw him in different ways and we see each other in different ways. And we can't see each other cleanly because we don't accept each other's perspective and each other's history. You know, I understand why these people like Donald Trump so much. I actually sympathize. I don't agree with them, but I empathize with them because they don't feel like someone's speaking for them. So then the question is, instead of saying, you know, they're a bunch of racists, the question is, how can we speak to them so they feel like they're being heard? It's really, you know, you have to ask the deeper questions and then you come up with solutions. So it really, in his life is a lesson for us in terms of, you know, to how we should treat each other. I think that's what he would have wanted.
Do you identify with him?
I mean, do I wish he was my daddy? You know, no.
No, not necessarily. No, do you identify with his struggles?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very good question. It's a very astute question. Yes, I do identify with him. I understand why he did a lot of the things he did. Because when you become a public person, first of all, people think you're a millionaire. They, you know, constantly asking you for money, constantly asking you for favors. Come visit my kindergarten class, you know, because they're black like you, unless you can talk to them. I can't because I'm white, you know, ridiculous stuff like that. People don't think you have any problems. And they don't really care about your pain because they see you as Goliath, no matter what you do.
They don't care about your pain?
Yeah, your pain doesn't count because you're Goliath. You're a big best-selling author. You have no problems. You never run out of gas or can't pay your bills. You know, you start to develop friendships that move in the direction where there's just peace. And you put up certain gates that you just don't allow people to get through. Mm-hmm. And in that part, this book helped me tremendously because I see what happens when you put too many gates up.
You get lonely, don't you?
You get lonely. And not only that, you suffer because it doesn't really matter that people think of you a certain way. You have to work to let them see your humanity and let them see you that you're still the same person.
How much – you sort of referenced this earlier in the hour about just the influence of the South, perhaps the South at that time, on James Brown himself. And in many ways, it does still feel like we live in a divided country when it comes to North and South.
Well, we do. We do. And unfortunately, we're learning our – you know, the culture we learn from television basically is a culture that says just, you know – you're in good hands, drink as much soda as possible, and if you can get cognac at the same time, why not? I just saw a commercial with this rapper that he's pouring wine on a cell phone to show that the cell phone is, you know, it's waterproof. I mean, this is what we're selling our children. Mm. So that's a problem that you know, supersedes region. But I think we still have some differences about North and South that we don't really work very well. And a lot of those are tied to race and a lot are tied to class.
Oh, to class. I mean, beyond the race issue. But
class is the big one. I mean, class is the real issue. I mean, class is really where, you know, where the rubber meets the road, because race is something that the powers that be just use to divide us. But, you know, many of us are still in the same class. And James Brown came from the class of poor people, and he respected poor people. He was, because they understood what it was like not to have. Mm. And when you're poor, you don't have time for these, these little, you know, what are you feeling inside type of moments. You just got to take care of business, you know.
We have an email from M.A. Do you know how Clyde Stubblefield came up with the drum part for James Brown's on I Got the Feeling It's the Best?
Well, you know what? Clyde Stubblefield grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And the sound of the choo-choo train outside his bedroom window was what he emulated on drums.
Oh, wow.
And that's how he came with it. I mean, I got the feeling it's very hard to count. It doesn't really feel like it falls in 4/4. You can sit there and try and count it any way you want, but it's Clyde Stubblefield landing on like the and of three or something like that. It makes it sound totally, totally different.
Wow. Just almost out of time here, but you quote a slave saying, this, I guess, obviously coming from the South, go here, go there, do nothing. What did that mean?
Well, it just means look busy so the white folks don't know what you, you know, you just, you're running around, you go back and forth, and they think you're busy and they leave you alone. That's what it means.
Did this influence you as a musician? Do you think about music differently, having spent so much time thinking about James Brown?
Yes and no. I think it helped me understand that all the training in the world, sometimes you overtrain yourself as a musician. The great musicians, many of them have not been formally trained. I mean, Thelonious Monk was not a great pianist at all, but he was a genius. And James Brown, you know, he was an organist. He played organ. He played drums. He wasn't formally trained. But the originality that comes from lack of formal training sometimes is a wonderful thing to have.
We're going to end on that note. James McBride, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Delighted. Thank you for having
me. You're
very
welcome. And the book is called Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we're going to close things out with another James Brown anthem, 1968, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud.